Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm in what's been called a terrorist attack. A man plows a truck through a Bastille Day crowd in Nice, France, killing at least 84 people. An international tribunal in The Hague rejects China's claim to the South China Sea. And Venezuela puts the military in charge of distributing food and medicine as shortages worsen. Joining me for this week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, Moises Naim of El País, Nancy Youssef of The Daily Beast, and Peter Bergen of CNN and New America. I hope you'll join us. 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Well, I must say, to end this week on this tragic note is really difficult. Peter Bergen, why don't you start us off?
Well, as you know, an attack happened in Nice last night the suspect has been identified as Mohamed Bouhel, a 31-year-old, married, divorced, father of three kids. No previous history of, at least he hadn't come to the attention of authorities for any kind of Islamist militant connections. He was a petty criminal. What's interesting, Dan, is I believe that this is the most lethal terrorist attack carried out by a lone terrorist in the West ever. And it demonstrates that we have to sort of maybe reconceptualize a little bit about what the limits of the lethality of a lone terrorist can be, because there's no indication that he had any co-conspirators or was part of a larger group.
And no one's taken responsibility.
Right. And the previously, you recall, Anders Breivik in Norway killed 77 people in 2011. That was the previous sort of height that one person had. You know, the amount of damage one person could inflict. So we're in a time where we have to, and obviously we had Orlando, the most lethal terrorist attack since 9/11 in the United States, killed 49. So we're looking at a situation where lone wolves can actually carry out attacks that actually have a large death toll, unfortunately.
Someone raised a question in our first hour about barricades and whether there were barricades for individuals and the public, but not for automobiles. How could that white truck get through there?
You can't defend against everything. I mean, you know, go back, let's say, to the Istanbul attack, which, of course, only happened in the last month or so. You know, there was some discussion, well, maybe you could extend the perimeter around the airport before you get to the arrivals area. Well, that just extends the problem to somewhere else because people gather around the perimeter to get inside the secure area to get to the arrivals area. So, you know, I mean, unless we're planning to basically turn every nightclub, hotel, theater, public gathering into some kind of fortress-like event, we're going to see these things again.
And we have at least two Americans killed, eight children killed, Nancy Youssef.
Yes, the prosecutors just announced actually 10 children killed. A man, Sean Copeland, who was on holiday from Texas with his son, Brody, was the American killed. I wanted to go back to something you raised about the use of the lorry and the lack of responsibility. On the lack of responsibility, there hasn't been any one claim, but there was an immediate talk about ISIS. We saw a lot of talk on their Telegram accounts. We saw local officials and national officials. We saw President Hollande's talk about ramping up the campaign against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. And I think that's interesting because it raises a question, do the authorities know something that we don't know about a possible ISIS connection? Or is there a conflation happening about ISIS with potential local in-country radicalization?
And in addition to the 84 killed, we have 202 injured, including 52 in critical condition. That's from the French prosecutor in Nice, Moises.
What's very interesting is about the profile of the perpetrator, of Mr. Buhel. He is a petty criminal. He was known to the police for he was prone to violence, but he was not known to the intelligence services. He did not show up in the radar of the counter-terrorist organizations. And the other interesting point is that he was not religious. People that know him say that, you know, he was not versed in...
But does this go to the point that ISIS is encouraging people, take action in your own home?
This is closely related to the fact that ISIS is losing, you know, has been dealt significant blows in the territory, you know, the physical caliphate, you know, the large stretch of land that they controlled in Syria and Iraq is now much has shrunk. Many of its leaders have been killed, and they are losing terrain, but they are winning in what is being called the cyber jihad. They are winning in creating and inspiring these lone wolves that then take matters in their own hands and don't need a lot of supervision, coordination, or supply of weapons or training.
This profile of the criminal is interesting also, because if you look at the Charlie Hebdo attacks where 12 people were killed and then 4 people in the supermarket that followed, if you look at the November 13th attacks in Paris where 130 people were killed, the Brussels attacks, every single one of those perpetrators pretty much had gone to jail in France. Now, astonishingly, 70% of the prison population is Muslim in a country where the Muslim population is only 10%. And I think that really speaks to the problem that France is having. Because France is facing a campaign of terrorism. These are not one-off events. I mean, we had Orlando. If you had multiple Orlandos over the space of 18 months in the United States, people would be really freaking out. And that is what we're seeing in France.
Wow. But that's why I think it's so important to talk about Hollande's decision within hours to say we're going to ramp up the campaign against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Because if this is a lone wolf a problem born out of self-radicalization within France, we are conflating the two. And I would argue giving ISIS more power by saying that they are inspiring things that maybe they're not. We don't know yet, and I think it's interesting that we don't know. It's very confusing because on one hand, you had all these accounts bragging about it, taking credit that are affiliated with ISIS, which is a hallmark of ISIS, and yet ISIS uses explosives. ISIS usually has more than one attacker, and so that's why we have this confusion about ISIS's role in it. But I think deconstructing what is inspired by ISIS, what is directed by ISIS, and what is a product of local radicalization within a country is so important, because the more we give ISIS credit for things that maybe the beauty of saying that of ISIS calling for inspired attacks is it allows them to take credit for something that maybe they had very little role in. And I think making that distinction becomes all the more important as we're seeing more and more attacks like this.
Peter.
We could defeat ISIS tomorrow, and the essential underlying problems are not going to disappear, and they are four. The regional civil war between the Sunni and Shia that is in Yemen, Iraq, and Syria. The collapse of Arab governance across the Middle East. The wave of massive immigration as a result of problems one and two into Europe. And the rise of European fascism. This is a very toxic mix. And when I say fascism, I mean ultra-nationalism. Choose your label. Those underlying conditions are not susceptible to any easy fixes, not in my professional lifetime, I don't think.
What's very interesting is that despite all of this, which is completely, it's right, you know, Donald Trump, for example, yesterday stated that he would declare war on ISIS. And so the difficulty there is, you know, what's the address? You know, where
Hillary
is...
Hillary Clinton used the word war
and so
as
that,
well.
That means we have entered into the era of the lone wolves that we know or don't know if they are associated with ISIS. We have entered an era in which the words that we used to rely on, like war and combatant and all that, are no longer clear. And the confusion that ensues is part of what also creates the difficulty of how you defend against these threats.
You know, it's interesting that people are using this idea of declaring war on ISIS. Up until recently, there was great celebration that ISIS was weaker, it had lost territory. There has been a war of sorts against the Islamic State. It's 2 years of strikes, a significant shrinkage of their their land grab in Iraq and Syria, fewer fighters going in, limited funds as the oil revenues have been cut, and they've destroyed literally millions of dollars. So we have seen military successes on the ground. So when people say one should go to war with ISIS, that war has in a sense been happening and has not been, as Peter pointed out, a foolproof means to mitigate the ISIS threat.
By the way, the Obama administration is conducting wars of various kinds in seven Muslim countries right now. I mean, is the idea we should go to war with 14 of them? Or what? This whole idea, I mean, Donald Trump doesn't seem to have read the Constitution, which is, you know, Congress is in charge of this declaration of war. The Obama administration has repeatedly asked Congress to come up with some kind of formulation about a war against Syria and Iraq, and they've just abdicated their responsibilities. So it doesn't matter what anybody says about this issue if Congress is simply unwilling to take a vote on this.
So what is France likely to do in the face of this latest attack?
You know, they have said multiple times last night, for instance, I mean, they are doing everything they can. I mean, short of turning France into a total police state, which is not going to happen, they're taking a lot of measures.
Peter Bergen, he's CNN's national security analyst. He's also the author of United States of Jihad, the untold story of Americans fighting for radical Islam. Short break, right back.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
Decius Daily. Sign up at decius.com/newsletter.
decius.com/newsletter.
And welcome back here in the studio, Nancy Youssef of The Daily Beast, Peter Bergen of CNN, Moises Naim of El País. He's the author of The End of Power, From Boardrooms to Battlefields and Churches to States, Why Being in Charge Isn't What It Used to Be. Now, Theresa May find out exactly about what you're writing.
And in fact, her ascent to power is a manifestation of the weakening and the constraints on the British Prime Minister. Cameron essentially launched the referendum in a way to try to secure his stay in power, and that backfired and ended up with him leaving. Theresa May is 59 years old, is the former Home Secretary, which in the UK means that she was in charge of crime policy, counterterrorism, immigration, passports, all the hot issues. She was not. She was anti-Brexit. She was not in favor of the UK exiting Europe, but she wasn't a vocal advocate. And she has said that Brexit means Brexit. That means that there will not be another referendum. There's not a do-over here, and that she is going to move forward to implement the implications of the vote. The detail there is that the implications are not clear.
All right. And what I'd like to know is how she arrived at the decision to select Boris Johnson.
Well, I think it's evidence that she has a sense of humor, because after all, Boris Johnson has insulted pretty much every significant leader around the globe. He described Hillary Clinton as a kind of a steely-eyed nurse from a mental hospital at one point. And he's insulted, you know, the Turkish leader. You can't think of anybody he hasn't insulted.
But why would she choose him?
Well, I mean, it's very puzzling. And also, you know, of course, Brexit is really, you know, Boris Johnson's, it's on his obituary. On it, it'll be, this was the principal, driver of this. And now he's going to be in the difficult position of having to negotiate the actual terms of Brexit. With the
but
French.
He's not a very good negotiator, considering.
Well, it is very puzzling, but I will say she seems Maggie Thatcher-like in her. I mean, there's really been a night of the long knives. Anybody who could possibly, be a threat to her, she's basically fired or got to resign. And I think, you know, she seems already to be quite an effective leader.
I'm going to offer a couple of theories, if I could, and see if it's plausible. Not just Boris Johnson, but a number of Brexit supporters she put in her cabinet in key posts, and that arguably buffers her from sort of the politics of negotiating the Brexit, one could argue, and allows her to focus on domestic reforms. That's an argument. And the counter-argument would be that having sort of a split within your own party and your own cabinet prolongs the uncertainty of what comes post-Brexit and how Brexit happens. So there are a number of interesting theories. I mean, if you want to get smug about it, he travels a lot if he's the foreign secretary. So
he'll be
out of the country. So that might be easier. And so those are the theories you hear about sort of possible reasons. But I think it's interesting. Several days later, nobody's quite sure. And the uncertainty he brings just by bringing him on, I think, prolongs potential economic instability for the UK because there's not a clear path ahead.
So Theresa May has distributed hot potatoes to her cabinet members and given very difficult tasks to those that were promoting those ideas. So while everybody is centering and paying attention to Boris Johnson and all the insults, he for example, said about President Obama that he's a symbol of the part Kenyan president's ancestral dislike of the British Empire as a result of President Obama's decision to move a bust of Churchill and so on. He has been insulting, as Peter said, everyone. But the person that I think needs more attention is David Davis, who is actually the secretary for exiting Europe. And he is a long-term backbencher, member of parliament, leader of the Tories. And he will lead the negotiations to define new arrangements between the UK and Europe.
I wonder about the British people's reaction to her selection of Boris Johnson, and whether they would, having heard these insults, having heard or seen the way he's behaved, whether they might have some question in their mind.
I don't think there's an American analog to Boris Johnson, really. I mean, people like Boris. I mean, he was, you know, pretty successful mayor of London, got elected twice. People are fond of him. I mean, it doesn't matter what he does. Huh. He keeps falling upwards. I mean, look, by the way, this is a big promotion to be Foreign Secretary from being Mayor of London.
Of course, of course.
provided he's successful, he can just also be a catastrophe.
Yeah.
All right. Let's turn our attention to the ruling in The Hague on claims to the South China Sea. And why, Moises, this is such a significant ruling?
So start with the fact that the South China Sea has shipping lanes that where a third of world trade goes through. It also has the U.S. thinks studies show that it has about 11 billion barrels of oil and about 190 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. So these are very rich sea, and China has been very aggressive in trying to take control of that, to the point in which it has defined the definition of island. So they took some rocks and started expanding the rocks and made them into an island, to the point in which one of those islands now has a 10,000 feet runway, and it has all kinds of military facilities. And there is talk that they are going to move people there to populate those former rocks and now islands. And the point is that those islands then generate sovereignties, according to them. Last week, the Permanent Court of Arbitration, a tribunal constituted under the UN Convention of the Sea in The Hague, rejected China's claim that to the South China Sea. And this is an important test. This is a test about. This is the first time that the Chinese government has been summoned to the international justice system, and it's also the first time that we are going to test if they are going to play by the rules or they are just going to ignore it. The government of China has already said that this is not enforceable and they are not going to pay attention to the ruling.
Nancy. Well, that is the problem, isn't it? I mean, it's not often you say the Hague sweeps Asia and offers such a solid win for the Philippines, which had brought the suit to them in 2013. But there is one Achilles heel in all this, which is the Hague cannot enforce this. And so what we're going to start to see, presumably, is that the Chinese will sort of test it, and they started to do that this week. They sent in two patrol boats. The Taiwan respondent sent in its own patrol boat because they're one of the six nations that believes that they have rights to the South China Sea. So the question becomes for the Americans, and maybe I'm coming at this as a military correspondent, is how does the U.S. respond? There's the risk of now escalation. You now have the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral John Richardson, traveling to China this week. If China violates it, how aggressively will the United States try to enforce this ruling? Because in the past, the United States has done patrols, naval patrols, and flights to maintain freedom of movement. But what happens when the Chinese, as they have threatened to do, challenge that? How much will the United States work to protect it, and at what risk?
And that's the question. What is the risk for the U.S. to challenge this, Peter?
Well, the risks are, you know, eventually a peer-to-peer war. I think the likelihood of that is very unlikely. After all, since China is essentially the United States banker, you don't usually kill your banker. I think it's important for listeners to understand what this dispute looks like when you look at it from a sort of 30,000 feet. The Chinese are claiming that 1,000 miles from their coastline, everything out is theirs. So it'd be like the United States saying, hey, pretty much every island in the Caribbean is actually American. I mean, this is a very, very unusual claim. The fact that they lost it is not surprising because, of course, it's not theirs. But they've, you know, if you go to a Chinese school, from day one, you're indoctrinated about the red dot line and that this is yours.
But the problem is the Chinese signed the Convention on the Law of the Sea, and the court found that by doing that, you have sort of foregone to the historical claims that you say that entitles you to that territory so far away from your borders. And so that was the legal means in which they were able to rule against them.
So how many years has this dispute been going on, and how many more years is it likely to go on, Nancy?
It's been going on for 40 plus, even because, you know, the Chinese will claim they had historically they were there, and they've tried to prove that, and then there have been counterclaims. How long it goes on? It's for the foreseeable future, because this is at a time that China is asserting its place in the world. Now, it hasn't done so as aggressively in other means as it is in the South China Sea. But this, again, the ruling is not enforceable. And so how many nations are the Vietnamese and the other states going to come together? That claim territory. Are they going to step up? What happens, as Moises said, that when the Chinese start to establish themselves, put populations there, how do you stop that? So it's hard to see how this is resolved anytime soon. But the fact that the ruling was so against the Chinese and what was fascinating, and the rhetoric we heard from them this week certainly suggested that they weren't going to back down.
By the way, just back on to the attack in France, the French prosecutor has said the ex-wife of the suspect is being detained for questioning. It was reported that she had been beaten by him.
And think of Orlando Martin in Orlando, a month ago. His first wife accused him of domestic abuse. Murderers often start by torturing or killing small animals. And it turns out the domestic abusers are violent people who often go on to do worse acts of violence or even, murder or whatever.
All right. Let's turn now to Venezuela. We've heard about these extreme food shortages, Moises. We now hear that the military has been tasked with distribution of those foods. How trustworthy is the military?
It is not really trustworthy because they have already been in charge of most of the ministries in charge of the food distribution and all that. This is just a way of justifying a takeover by the military, explaining it as a way of dealing with the crisis in food and in medicines. Something like 82% of Venezuelan surveys say that they now eat less than they used to a year ago. 52% of those surveys say that they cannot eat three times a day. And this is happening in the country with the largest oil reserves in the world and the worst managed economy in the world also.
How did they get to this place?
It's a combination of bad policies and bad ideas and a lot of oil that they thought could sustain them. Once the oil prices went down and essentially the government has run out of dollars to import, and before that they had destroyed the domestic capacity to produce, so the country is completely dependent on imports and it doesn't have the hard currency to pay for those imports.
Moises Naim of El País, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Nancy, might there be a vote to remove President Maduro Venezuela from office?
Well, the thinking is that at some point there will be a call for no confidence vote, and that would lead to a new election, that would sort of be the channels in which you would have the kind of reforms. It's interesting, you know, you hear Moises speak and one thinks, well, why would the president hand over so much authority to the military? Because of the risk associated with it. And the truth is because he doesn't have any choice. I don't know if we can in this country appreciate every day, Venezuelans are getting up and standing in the lines for hours and hours and hours all day, and sometimes coming out with nothing at a time when we're at triple-digit inflation and oil prices at their lowest. And my concern is when I hear about this, and maybe this is the Egyptian in me speaking, that militaries inherently are not prone to offer economic, long-term, enduring economic solutions. And so how you get out of this predicament is it's very hard to see with the sort of ideas being put forth this week.
All right. We have a number of callers waiting. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Elaine in Lanham, Maryland. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Great show, as
Thanks.
Always.
Thanks.
I just wanted to comment. I heard the panel talking about why Mrs. May has appointed, why would she appoint Boris Johnson, and he's a loose cannon, essentially. He's the British version, to me, of Donald Trump, even down to his crazy hairstyle. So, you know, it may be that the same thing that is attracting people to Donald Trump, which I think is his entertainment value, if you want to call it that, is probably some of the same thing that has attracted the Brits. And maybe they want entertainment with their bad news. I don't know.
What do you think, Peter Bergen?
Boris Johnson is quite different from Donald Trump in lots of ways. I mean, you know, he's not in the business world. He edited The Spectator, which is a conservative magazine, quite a good magazine, had a fairly distinguished career doing that. He was mayor of London. He engaged in conventional electoral politics. He was an important member of the Conservative Party. He's not really the outsider. I mean, Donald Trump has no political.
So, yeah. But in terms of his outspokenness, in terms of his capacity for insults, in terms of his not caring what he says or who he snarks
I'm
about.
I'm not going to go down that route.
You're not?
No.
Okay. What do you think, Nancy?
Well, I mean, to me, it just speaks to the sort of the polarization of the world around us, where the idea of sort of appealing to the middle and speaking it to that way is giving way to an expectation that people speak as aggressively as one feels in the kind of increased polarized environment we're finding ourselves in.
It may not be that complicated. 17 million British citizens voted in favor of Brexit, and Boris Johnson was the leader of that campaign.
Moises Naim of El País, When we come back, we'll talk about the NATO summit in South Sudan and take your calls, 800-433-8850. And welcome back. Let's open the phones to Albemarle, North Carolina. And Ben, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. You know, I've been listening to the show, and it's making me think. I want to ask the panel, you may have mentioned it, I'm not sure, but what is it that in recent times has made France a target for these ISIS and terrorist attacks?
Yeah, basically, you know, here's a telling statistic. If you have a Muslim name and you go for a job interview, you're two and a half times less likely to be called to that job interview than somebody that has a Christian name. So, I mean, you know, just the level of discrimination is very high. The French are, you know, they don't like their immigrant population. Obviously, you know, that's reflected in the fact that the French have supplied more foreign fighters to ISIS than any other country in the West.
All right. To Felicity in Wichita, Kansas.
Hi, Diane. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I am wondering, I know that the French president, François Hollande, has extended the state of emergency for France for another 3 months after the Nice attack. And I'm wondering what that extension of state of emergency means for the U.S. and for, you know, French-U.S. relations.
Interesting.
It's a very interesting question. You know, in the hours before this attack, Hollande had lifted the state of emergency that had been in place and had said at the time, we can't live in a state of emergency forever, on Thursday. And so broadly speaking, what the state of emergency does is allows for more aggressive police practices, searches, things of that sort.
Stopping people for no reason.
I don't know the specifics of French law to tell you, but it just gives them more legal freedoms. Now, in terms of how it affects the United States, that's a very interesting question, and I'd just be conjecturing. I think the current state of emergency in France will be for 3 months, and what does it do to a world community when you have a major player like France living in that long of a state of emergency? Does it raise sort of a heightened sense of security around the world? We'll have to see.
And that leads us to a question about NATO. The summit concluded last weekend, and some of those members are saying we are in a brand new Cold War, Moises.
Indeed. They met, and they're very worried about the Baltic region. There's nine countries, including Russia, that have shorelines there, and there have been increasing tensions, and their worry is that Russia and the Kremlin has designs to recover some of those countries that used to be part of the Soviet Union, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and all of that. They decided that they would have a multinational force of up to 4,000 troops in the Baltic region. And then 3,500 American troops will rotate in different countries.
What was Vladimir Putin's reaction to that?
That it was a belligerent move. That building up NATO capabilities runs counter to the stability of the region, that was creating sources of friction and instability.
Okay, but now let's take this back to the relationship between the President of the United States and Vladimir Putin as a result of what's happened in France. Does that have an impact on their relationship, Peter?
Well, I think their relationship is very, very bad. And
right now.
But I think their relationship is bad. I mean, Obama does not like Putin at all and regards him as a bully. And so, you know, that's not going to change. Is it possible that, you know, there might be a little bit more agreement about what to do on Syria? You know, it's not out of the question. But, I mean, the Syrian, as Nancy was sort of indicating earlier in the program, I mean, Syria is not a problem that's going to be fixed anytime, you know, in the next several years.
Probably in my lifetime. Let's go to Mark in Milton, Florida. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diana. I was calling in regards to Venezuela and the bad decisions, the shortage of food, people exiting the country with what they can carry. It was all due to socialism. Look at North Korea, where people starve to death and rummage across the landscape eating leaves and grass. And look at the former Soviet Union. The only bright spot in China is the part that capitalism is allowed to exist. And but for the most part, they made bad decisions, like building cities that no one can afford to live in, and they're empty. It's socialism is a failed ideology. It fails everywhere. Even the Nordic countries, Sweden is exporting people that they invited in. And they're going bankrupt. Denmark is falling back off of their socialist policies because they're going broke.
Do those countries have similarities to Venezuela?
Venezuelans will pay anything to have the kind of socialism that they have in Sweden. What's going on in Venezuela is a strong rhetoric about socialism that was launched by President Chavez with his Bolivarian Revolution and what he called the socialism of the 21st century. But in fact, it is about kleptocracy. It is about stealing.
Kleptocracy
is kleptocrats in power, people stealing blindly from the resources of the state, and incompetence. This has been a significantly incompetent regime that has tolerated corruption levels that are...
Explain to me how that kleptocracy could have gone on for so long while the government was still operating, and then all of a sudden...
The government was getting about $100 billion a year in oil exports,
right,
and indebted the country to the hilt. And one day, the international credit markets dried up, and the price of oil went down, and the number of barrels of oil that could be sold also shrank because they had sold them in advance. And even if they shipped them, they could not take the money because they had already committed them. And so a combination of dwindling production levels, malfeasance, and ineptitude create the conditions that create the Venezuelan tragedy today.
All right. Let's go to Cleveland, Ohio. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. I've said it before. You're a national treasure.
Thanks.
Before Pearl Harbor, it was agreed in this country that fascism in general and German National Socialism in particular could never be defeated. The children were brainwashed. The soldiers were willing to die for their Führer, but we did it. It took a worldwide coalition and a complete sweep of the region, but we turned it around. And I hate to say it, but I think that's the only thing that's going to stem this radical Islamic terrorism. A worldwide coalition is what it's going to take, and you got to do it now. Strike while the iron's hot. I'm sure a number of countries to commit to going in and cleaning it up.
Comparisons to World War II don't really work. I mean, look, in World War II, 18 million men and women served in the military. Today, you know, the number is, you know, a small fraction of that. We spent 40% of our GDP on military during World War II. We're spending, you know, 3 or 4% today. They're apples and oranges. 60 million people died in World War II. There's not an American in the country who wants to do a, you know, massive sort of invasion of the Middle East. Even the most right-wing or the most conservative Republican candidates, Lindsey Graham, was talking about 20,000 troops. And he was one of the first people out of the race. So there's no constituency in the United States for some massive ground war in the Middle East. And plus, it wouldn't work. I mean, ISIS is a relatively small group.
Then what is it that Donald Trump is saying when he's calling for a war?
I don't know. I understand the caller's frustration because what I hear him saying is it's been this drip, drip of war since 2003 against an enemy that, rather than being defeated, is actually becoming more sophisticated, more lethal, more barbaric. I understand the frustration. And maybe this is the Arabist in me, but I think there's a limit to what the U.S. military can do for a region that has to fix its own problems. We're taught, I mean, in Egypt, in Syria, in Iraq, they're unstable governments, unstable economies, and uneducated populations that are being taught a brand of Islam that is not one that most of us recognize and allow for terror groups to essentially hijack Islam. There is a limit to what the U.S. can do to change the outcome in other countries. Ultimately, the change will happen within the region. I understand the caller's frustration. I share it. And I wish that there was a military commitment. I feel like given the commitment this U.S. military has made to the region, if there were a military solution, they would have crafted it.
Here's an email from Mario. Could Theresa May have appointed Boris Johnson as foreign secretary, hoping he will fail and end his political career? Peter.
Well, as we were all agreeing in the break, she wins either way. If he succeeds, she succeeds. If he loses, she neutralizes a potential, challenger to her as a prime minister.
All right. And an email from Efrain in Pittsboro, North Carolina, who is somewhat blaming the victim. He says the municipal and regional governments of Nice screwed up royally. There should never be a large crowd gathered in any Western city without major vehicular control barriers. This has been repeated with the Marine Detachment in Beirut and many other locations in Iraq. There is no longer a normal celebration or demonstration.
I hear the frustration, but practically speaking, look, in Iraq, they had this problem. And when you went in Baghdad at the height of the wars, and there were T-walls, 12-foot walls over around every major road leading to every major city or neighborhood within Baghdad. And those walls are still up. That's the kind of level of protection that would be involved to mitigate against this threat. I mean, there's a rebellion within, I think, everyone to say that we don't want to live in sort of this warlike state. And once those walls go up, at least if what Baghdad teaches us is it's very hard to bring them back down. And so I think it's premature to be blaming the municipality because to me, that's the kind of security measure you would need in place to stop a madman with a lorry willing to drive it at full speed into a crowd of people.
All right. And Moise's fighting erupted again in South Sudan. What's happening?
The president and the vice president are fighting. They both want to control the country. This is the youngest country in the world. Last Saturday, it was its fifth anniversary of independence from Sudan. They were together in fighting for independence. And once they became an independent country, the president and vice president had their own. Each one has their own army, and each one distrusts the other. And they've had a war for 2.5 years in which 50,000 people were killed, 2 million people were displaced, and then there was a ceasefire. And last week, just a minor altercation erupted into violence again. And there is a great concern that this can escalate again into an all-out civil war.
All right. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's take a caller from Toledo, Ohio. Jeff, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Diane.
Sure.
My question is for the panel, and it involves the ruling in the South China Sea. You made a good point that likely there'll be that conflict between the Chinese and America is unlikely, but what chances are there that a conflict between the Philippines and China or Vietnam and China drags the United States into a war that it wouldn't have chosen otherwise?
Moises?
All the countries that are involved that have maritime interest in the South China Sea have a deep economic dependence on China. So it's not that easy. The Philippines is not going to go into war with China, nor is Vietnam. Again, the economic interdependency with China is just too significant.
And the U.S. military is not eager to in any way feel that the reason for freedom of the ships and the aircraft happen is to protect freedom of movement, not to in any way escalate. The goal is de-escalation and protecting the passage through the South China Sea.
So, Peter, what do you want to wind up this hour by saying what's happened in France?
Unfortunately, we're going to see more of this in Europe. In the United States, we're insulated from it by both geography and, to some degree, the American dream. You can drive from Paris to Damascus. You can't drive from Damascus to Washington. We've had relatively small numbers of Americans go and volunteer for ISIS. I mean, really a handful, a number of them are dead. None of them have come back. This is a real problem for Europe that is going to be generational. For the United States, we're somewhat insulated from it, thankfully.
Nancy?
Well, I mean, I don't know if your viewers or listeners feel this way, but there's such an exhaustion that you feel amongst all of us week after week after week, having to hear about these events. And so you hope that sort of leads to some really substantive conversations about not who to blame or who to attack or who to ostracize or who to deport, but really concrete and creative solutions to get at this problem, because that's what it demands. It demands a level of imagination that we haven't had to deploy yet because of the depth of the problem that we're dealing with.
I concur with that. We have entered a very dangerous period that is rendered even more dangerous by simplification, by terrible simplicity, and we have to be very careful about converting bad ideas into policies.
Moises, Naeem, Nancy Youssef, Peter Bergen, thank you all so much.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
And I do want to let listeners know I will be on vacation for the next couple of weeks. You all had some wonderful people sitting in this chair. I'll be back with you on August the 2nd. In the meantime, be safe and keep listening. Thanks. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Alexandra Boti, Susan Casey, Danielle Knight, and Allison Brody. The engineer is Alex Drewenskis. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, and podcasts. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR. Thank you.